there's a huge discrepancy between the quality of technology between these companies. And what I think you're seeing is that the companies that actually have the goods, that have actually produced the technology that is safe, that is reliable, doesn't have integrity issues or data crashes, etc., those are the companies that are still around.
Hello and welcome to the Autonicast. I'm Ed Niedermeyer. I'm the author of Ludicrous, the Unvarnished Story of Tesla Motors.
And I'm Kirsten Korosek, transportation editor at TechCrunch.
And I'm Alex Roy, the founder of the Human Driving Association and the finest consultancy advisory business in the business, Johnson & Roy. But most importantly, I don't hate innovation like Ed Niedermeyer. And today we're going to prove it. I, unlike Ed, can admit when I was wrong. And we had an episode at some point in 2023, we're talking about M&A. We do this every year. And I'm like, yeah, of course, the good companies will get acquired and the others will just go away. And of course, like Kodiak, these guys, they'll get acquired. And boy, was I wrong. Not only was I wrong, but when today's guest, Kodiak CEO and founder Don Burnett, came to the Autonicast party in Vegas this past January, he gave me a look. We have both understood what that look meant. He had to come on the show and explain why they were never getting acquired and Kodiak is killing it. Don Burnett, welcome to the Autonicast.
It's great to be back.
Tell me what that look meant. What was going on in January that you then announced a few months later?
Well, I think that if we go way back to the first time I was on the show, you made the prediction or you made the statement that every time someone comes on the show, they seem to be acquired within the next 6 months, and you hoped that wasn't going to be the case this time. And I told you I don't think it's going to be the case. I think it was like 4 or 5 years ago now, so it's been a long road, pun intended. And a lot of things have changed. The marketplace has matured. Industries and business models are starting to mature around autonomy. I think since the last time we've talked on the show, a bunch of the autonomous trucking companies have kind of gone away. The industry has crystallized a little bit. And now we're seeing even more crystallization around what business models actually make sense. What does a timely deployment look like? We're starting to see some driverless deployments. I'm sure we're going to talk a little bit more about that. And there's a proliferation of various industries that people are starting to work on. So at CES, we announced our sixth generation platform. So we've been around for about 6.5 years now. We've built a new truck up just about every year, learning from the experience of the previous generation, adding new capabilities and new benefits. And one of the things we were so excited to announce was the creation of our fully redundant truck. We've talked about redundancy on the show in the past. I know you've talked about it with a lot of other folks as well. And I've always defined autonomy in terms of the word redundancy. Well, we finally have now a fully manufacturable redundant truck, including redundant braking, redundant power, redundant steering, all the pieces that we need to safely and responsibly deploy a driverless solution. And we were really the first ones in the industry to announce that. We worked directly with the tier one suppliers to produce this truck. We architected it ourselves. We designed it, we built it, we tested it, and we validated it. And now it's ready to go. And now it's actually being put into production. So it's a really exciting time. Of course, fast forward another 8 months or so, and we've announced another major partnership, this time Atlas Energy Solutions, where we've actually commercialized off-road driving. So I'm really excited to talk about that here today as well.
So before we get into that, so there's some really interesting, you know, tech development stuff and new partnership, all kinds of things happening. But to kind of piggyback on Alex's question, right? And you mentioned there's been a lot of trucking companies, AV trucking companies were sort of this, there was this moment where AV trucking was like the thing in the space. A number of those companies have gone away. And this is sort of something that's going on in the rest of the space. And I'm really curious to get your thoughts about it, right? Like on the one hand, consolidation for those players who were able to put themselves in a position to survive, right? You've got less competition. You have for, you know, partnerships, for investment, for all the things you need to continue to develop these systems and succeed. On the other hand, it can be a little bit of a scary thing too, right? You lose too many players from the space and all of a sudden maybe investors get spooked and they say, oh, maybe, you know, so I'm curious sort of how you see that balance sort of right now, because I think that's one of the really interesting things about the AV space right now.
Well, the last 2 years have been a challenging time for everyone. No question when it comes to the investors, the markets, just the amount of the deployment of capital. Basically, if you weren't buying GPUs and creating a new chatbot, you're finding it difficult to get funding. And so we've had to really think strategically about what is the messaging, what is the promise. If you look at the history of the autonomous vehicle space, it's always been about the holy grail, revolutionizing transportation. You tell people, look, this technology is coming. It's going to be amazing. It's going to change the world. It's going to save lives. And it is going to be all of those things. But the challenge we've always had, which you guys are acutely aware of, is the timing. Which is, when is it coming? How long is it going to take? And how much capital is it going to take to get there? And I think we've all been a bit naive, to be honest with you. And I'll put myself in that camp as well. We being the folks who've been around self-driving space for decades plus, we've been a bit naive in our approach to the business model. If you look at other businesses, like look at Tesla, look at SpaceX, look at what Elon's done, there have always been intermediate milestones along the way to global domination, right? Or in SpaceX's case, colonizing Mars, becoming a multiplanetary species. Well, Elon's really talking about that now, but it's been 20 plus years and SpaceX has had a lot of successes along the way. Whereas AV companies seemingly thought, well, we don't need any intermediate milestones. We don't need any intermediate value. We're just going to go for the end game. And people are going to trust us until we get there. And by and large, to be fair, investors trusted us for a very long time. And I think investors are now getting a lot wiser about the realities of deployment of driverless systems. And they're starting to look for those niches and those business models that are actually a lot more tangible. They're here today and they can start to generate revenues. And I talked about this on the last show. It's all about business model versus your cost basis. Right? How much money are you burning? And can you show a path to profitability? I think the new name of the game for investors and the new name of the game for CEOs like myself is path to profitability. And can I verify that? Can I prove that I have a clear path? Do I have the contracts in place? Do I have the supply chain in place? Do I have the technology in place today? And can you envision a very concrete path as opposed to a hypothetical one, which is what everybody has really been basing their predictions on in the past. And the truth of the matter is, we just don't know how long it's going to take over the world with autonomous vehicles. And so in the meantime, we need to find intermediate value creation that allows us to show investors, hey, there's a real return here, and we're going to be in it for the long run.
So you talked about naivete and the lack of business model, and that seems to be potentially the driving factors of what caused so many of these companies to fold or to consolidate. But then again, in the beginning, we're talking about frontier tech, really. Like, so it's hard in the beginning to have a known business model. You're not a software as a service product and that is like has a baked in, revenue driver from the beginning. So in your view, now looking back, what has driven most of the, let's say, failures or consolidation in the market around AVs in the last couple of years? Is it just as simple as you said, naivete and lack of business model, or is there something else?
It's actually something else, and it's painfully difficult for me to explain to people, unfortunately. And it comes down to the technology, I think, at the end of the day. When people who are not intimately familiar with the tech look into our industry from the outside, they see it all as kind of the same, right? You've got vehicles roaming around the streets. You've got demos that you can ride in. People have sensors on their vehicle. They have computers inside their vehicle. And it mostly works most of the time. Seems pretty promising. Everybody's telling the same story. And so when you look at that as a non-expert or somebody who's not intimately familiar with the architectures and the underlying technology, you can be forgiven for seeing a sea of uniformity. However, when I look at this, and it's something that I've seen for a very long time, and I know there are a few others in the space, possibly Alex as well, because you've been intimately familiar with this as well, there's a huge discrepancy between the quality of technology between these companies. And again, I can't pinpoint it for you. I can't articulate it in a way that's easy for lay people to understand, but that it's there. And what I think you're seeing is that the companies that actually have the goods, that have actually produced the technology that is safe, that is reliable, doesn't turn off every hour or whatever time frame you pick, doesn't have integrity issues or data crashes, et cetera, those are the companies that are still around. I don't think it really is business model. Now, the next stage, what is going to distinguish the next wave of success is going to be more around strategy and go-to-market and customers. But up until now, I think the truth of the matter is, whether people want to accept this answer or not, I think it really has come down to the companies that have proven the technology works are by and large still around. And the companies that were sort of struggling and their investors sensed that, hey, there's no end in sight here. We're just going to have to pump, a lot more money to get to the promised land. Those companies have struggled and ultimately shut down.
All right, let's talk about naivete.
I just really quick, Alex, I want to imagine listeners writing down the different descriptions that Don just mentioned and trying to match them to different AV companies.
We know who they are. Everybody knows. All right. Now we're going to get controversial. Okay. So one of the things which I find astounding is naivete around go to market. So let's imagine you had all these, everybody in the sector had technology that worked perfectly. The go-to-market is everything. You announced that you're working on some dual-use applications. And by dual-use, for anyone who doesn't know what this means, civilian or potentially government or military contracts. Now, I'm going to flat out say it, okay? I am astounded at the naivete of people who think that the world is a nice, friendly, happy place and that no technology company should ever work in anything defense-related, ever. It is every generation forgets this until something bad happens in the world, and then everyone starts investing in dual-use companies. So I was thrilled to see that you announced that you were working on this, because there are 1,000 reasons to justify it. Could you talk about when the decision was made that you would pursue a dual-use strategy? Because so many companies try to do it on the down low or don't do it, which I find contemptible. Tell us about your thoughts.
Well, first off, I think dual use has really become a buzzword. I think a lot of companies who claim to be dual use struggle to actually prove that they have multiple uses for the technology they're building. They tend to be in two camps. They tend to either be heavily on the commercial side with some aspirations to be a defense company, or they're very much defense companies with some claims to be commercial companies. I think Kodiak has really found and struck the balance between finding a true single technology stack that has been able to be successful in both arenas. Taking a step back, most of us, certainly myself included, got into autonomy originally because of safety, right? It's all about saving lives. I was not an entrepreneur originally. I never imagined myself starting a business or even thinking about this as an industry, right? It was a research project when I got into it. And I'd already decided I wanted to dedicate my life to this, and it was because of safety. Now, I think there's a lot more possibilities today, and I'm excited where things have gone, but ultimately it comes down to safety. And I think if you're being honest with yourself, you need to look at a broad spectrum of where can you help save lives. And it's very clear that in a defense space, we have the opportunity to save lives. And so it's always been in the back of my mind as a possible application of the technology. And then you have to look for opportunities when they arise. Ground-based autonomy is hard. I think that's not a surprise to anyone. And in particular, it's hard in unstructured environments. So the Army has been trying to find autonomous technology that works in these kind of off-road, unstructured environments for over a decade. But a lot of the traditional defense players don't have that modern software AI DNA that allows them to deploy the state-of-the-art technology. So they actually came through the DIU, Defense Innovation Unit, which is based out here in Silicon Valley. They actually came to us and they put out an RFP back in 2022 that said, we want to find software-based AI companies that can deploy this technology for our use case. And we said, hey, this is our big chance. Now, one of the things you should know about the transition to dual use and defense is that you really can't rely on any type of prior mapping technology. So this is one of those innovative decisions that we made early on. And, you know, massive credit to the original team at Kodiak for kind of having the foresight to go down this road. You know, our CTO, Andy Wendell, myself, and several others really made some good decisions way back in the day that has enabled a lot of the business models that we're pursuing today. And if we had gone a different path, it would have been much, much harder. Because obviously in a defense case, you can't pre-map the environment. You can't go in ahead of time. You have to be able to go through environments that you've never seen before. And that's something that Kodiak was already able to do. And so when the opportunity came around in 2022, it was a no-brainer for us. And I think there's been a groundswell, possibly for the reasons that you mentioned, Alex, around defense. 7 years ago, nobody would touch defense. You couldn't even bring up the topic. You couldn't even say it. Like, you would have been ostracized. You would have been shunned. But now, nowadays, I think it's very much in vogue. There's a lot of support for defense. People recognize that we're doing a good for our country, for our allies. And it's an essential technology for the next generation of warfare. So, you know, the technology was right. We set up the company to have the opportunity to pursue it. And due to circumstances around the world, I think a lot of people have changed their mindset around supporting these types of
initiatives. Were you the first trucking, AV trucking company to make that decision in the US?
You mean to go with the military or go off-road?
Go with the military.
Okay.
I think we were the first commercial trucking company first to make the transition to the defense space. There were certainly other companies already working on defense that would have called themselves trucking companies or autonomous companies. But they started in defense. And I think that also puts you at a little bit of disadvantage because our technology and one of the benefits of our technology is the maturity and the reliability. We built our stack to run continuously over the road on long stretches of highway environment where, you know, the computers can never crash. They always have to be running. They have to be reliable. It's a pretty rugged environment, et cetera. So we had 3.5 million miles of experience that we brought to the military application. Whereas if you're a defense first company, you know, you've got one of those dune buggies running around on your little test track. You're not really accumulating the kind of data to build a reliable system, and you're not gathering the type of data modern AI algorithms require. So it's almost like you're starting on the back foot.
I had a question though about the mapping piece. So recently I was chatting with one of your old colleagues, Anthony Lewandowski, over at Pronto.
No, you weren't. What are you doing?
Because of what Pronto is doing also in unmapped, you know, off-road AV, you know, applying it not to the military, as far as I know, but more with these, you know, hauling trucks at mining sites and things like that. So we were talking about that, and they don't use LiDAR. They use vision only. It's unmapped. So what are you doing in these environments? And is it similar or something else?
It's a great question. And I think this is an important distinction that I want to make for folks, because when you think of off-road autonomy, there's different categorizations of off-road use cases. And what Pronto is pursuing with these large vehicles in the mining environments is much more structured and it's much more controlled. So in our industrial application, what we're calling industrial logistics, we're off-road, but it's still rules of the road. And here's how I break it down for people. Here's the way to think about the difference between the mining environment versus what Kodiak is doing. It's all about priority traffic. If you get priority, you're in one class. If you are equal priority, you're in the other class. Kodiak operates in an equal priority environment, meaning we don't get any priority around, you know, amongst other vehicles that we're operating on. So all of the rules of the road apply, and you need a full mature autonomy stack in order to navigate those environments. They may be sparser, they may be more remote, there may be less dense, etc., but they're still roadways that are bidirectional with traffic and pedestrians and motorcycles and trucks and everything that you would see on the road that you have to handle. Whereas in the mining environment, if you walk in front of one of those 40,000 ton trucks, it will stop and it will wait for you and you will get yelled at and then you'll move away and then it will continue. That truck has the priority in that environment. And so it's a little bit of a different technology. It's still an important application and it's obviously been deployed, but it's not quite the same thing that we're doing. We're tackling a much more generalized AI challenge in an off-road context, if that makes sense.
It's a little bit, I mean, right, so we're sort of talking about like this blurry area between sort of on-road automation or on-road style sort of approach to automation versus a more, it sounds like a little bit more of like an industrial automation approach, right? My understanding is a lot of these really, really big mining trucks, I mean, sometimes they're the only type of that vehicle on the road that they're using. They're essentially kind of, right, it's a little bit more like and I know like AGVs in a factory are like line following robots. I'm not trying to imply that it's that simple, but it's a little bit more like that in terms of repeating a task with the ability to avoid an obstacle coming versus actually engaging in like something more approximating real traffic. Is that sort of a good way to think about it?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the environments that we're operating in industrial, it's full traffic environment. It's just, you know, if you drove your truck or your car out there, it would be just like you're driving down a regular street. It just so happens to be a dirt path instead of asphalt.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and it's the variety of like vehicles and other actors that you're likely to encounter, right? That it's the diversity of what you're going to see on the street scene that kind of creates that need for a more robust sort of approach.
Exactly. It's not a fully controlled environment, right? It's not fenced off. It's not gated. You know, people can show up with all kinds of crazy looking things that you've never seen before that your system has to handle that it hasn't seen before. And in fact, I would argue that you even see a wider variety of strange looking vehicles because you've got all kinds of specialty hauling vehicles out there, different types of trailers that look non-conventional. You have different types of machinery and equipment that are moving in and out of those sites. They're building up well sites. They're taking well sites down. And so you get long trucks with weird pipes and other things that are hanging off. So it is still a very challenging environment, but it's one where, to be honest with you, just to give you a sense for how generalized our system was, when we started operating in that environment, it took us about 6 weeks to go from first drive to fully driverless. And so we've been operating driverlessly in that area since February of this year. So it's been about 6 months now, and the results are absolutely staggering.
I want to talk about that a little bit in terms of technological breakthroughs. Maybe they can't be categorized as breakthroughs, and there may be more mini steps along the way, but if you go back to your research project days, that wasn't the approach, right? I mean, certainly neural networks were known and were part of research, but in terms of applying it in the way you're applying it today, what was the milestone or technological breakthroughs that have happened in the last 5 years or so that have allowed you to take this approach? Or did it always exist? And you could have, just no one was taking this approach.
There's been a steady stream of technological advancements that have led us to the capabilities that we have today. And most of them are based around modern AI approaches, or as we would say, machine learning approaches, right? The algorithms change almost every year. So the approaches and algorithms and research being done is at an accelerating pace. And there's a lot of published work, there's a lot of academic work, there's a lot of conferences. Believe it or not, despite the fact that we're all at different companies, there's a lot of sharing of ideas at academic conferences. And so the technology continues to improve. Of course, we continue to innovate as well. And everybody has a little bit of their different flavor and different take on the AI algorithms and machine learning algorithms. But our approach comes down to redundancy, like anything else. And we have over 38, I think the latest count, maybe 39 different machine learning networks that are running through our system. Some of them are generalized end-to-end systems like you might see in Vogue, and we have those as well. But we don't think that's sufficient because it's not verifiable. We want to have verifiable algorithms throughout our system that can provide gates and checks that we can validate to make sure that it's performing correctly. And so we have all these other specialized algorithms that kind of sit around the one large fused end-to-end approach that allow us to have insight into what the system is thinking. And I think one of the most novel or impactful innovations of the last several years is the idea that a lot of different algorithms can share a central kind of trunk. You know, they can start from the same generalized brain, if you will, and then you can pull off pieces of the same brain into different specialized algorithms. So instead of training a bunch of independent machine learning models, you first start with one generalized model that understands the idea of what the environment is like, and then you train branches off of that single model that allows you to have specialized inference or ask specific questions. And that really has been one of the biggest advancements, because there's all kinds of auto-labeling and auto-training algorithms out there now where you can feed if you have sufficient data. And that this is where, you know, data was really, really important in the late teens. And then data volumes became a little bit less important of like four or five years ago. And now it's starting to become more important again, because if you have sufficient data with sufficient generality, then you can train kind of a generic algorithm that just learns about the environment. It doesn't answer specific questions, or it doesn't provide specific outputs, but you can then take that and specialize it to ask specific questions and get specific outputs. And that's really where the technology has evolved. That's where it's going in the future. And the promise and progress that we've seen over the last, say, year and a half has been incredibly impressive. And it continues to be impressive, like as we go. Like even this week, we had another major breakthrough, another release in our perception algorithm that the team was super excited about. So, you know, progress is accelerating, if anything.
Can you talk?
And this is the transformer. Sorry, just to clarify, this is the transformer sort of approach that you're talking about here.
Yeah, it's not exactly the same architecture that you'd use, say, in an LLM, but now there's these the VLMs, you know, visual. Learning models, visual language models that are allowing us to apply similar like techniques. I don't want to say it's the same, because it's not the same, and somebody who's really technically competent will point out that that's actually wrong.
Yep.
So I'm simplifying here.
For sure.
But in a lot of the same approaches, you feed in a bunch of images of the world or videos of the world, just like you would feed an LLM a bunch of text, and it sort of just learns what the world is. It's like, okay, I understand how the world works and what things tend to go together and what associations I can make. And then from there, you can train specialized learning models or specialized models that will actually answer questions that are relevant for driving.
I wanted to follow up and talk about the data component, because I do think that there is a lot of confusion around that, because you'll see companies from Tesla to other AV companies working on L4 talking about data and miles driven and how much data they have. So I'm hoping you can clarify, like, it isn't just data. What is the data that is actually valuable? Because it's not all data is created equally, right? Like, we can't just like force a funnel of data and then like it can make value out of that, right? So walk us through that, and what kind of data are you talking about, and what is the difference between valuable data and just what other folks might be doing?
Yeah, you kind of answered the question in the question, right? What we've learned over the last 5, 6, 7 years is that it's not just the amount of data. Like in the early machine learning explosion days, it was all about bigger data, bigger data, bigger data. And there's some evidence that suggests that with the LLMs and the chatbots, it does seem to still correlate between the more language data you can feed the model, the better the model ends up being. But what we kind of, before the LLM transformer hype, there was this kind of turn back toward quality as opposed to quantity. And what we learned is you can get similar results with high quality data that you could with low quality, but massive amounts of it. So higher quality, lower volume can be as good, if not better, than higher volume, lower quality. And for a while, the trend was all about how do you extract the highest quality data? And what does that mean? What does it even mean to have high quality? You need to find specific instances that are specific examples, and you need to label them correctly, and you need to make sure that the quality of your labels is good. And there was a whole industry built up over labeling. That is still true today, but what's happened is you've kind of come back to both worlds that are important. Because training the generalized first step, where you're just going to feed it data that's unlabeled, basically unlabeled, unsupervised training, that tends to benefit from volume of data, and it's not as important about the quality. But when it comes to then taking that kind of initial stage and filtering it down into answering specific questions, you're back to a quality over quantity perspective. And so both are very important, but there's very much diminishing returns. So if you just go drive around the block over and over and over and over again, and you collect years worth of data driving around the block, is that going to be better than a couple days worth of data driving around the block? Probably not, right? You need a diversity of data, which is why it's so important that in our commercial network, we are driving all across the southern United States. We're not just driving from Dallas to Houston, where we see the same highway, same merges, same exits, same everything every day. We want to get as much diversity of data. And then we've started to pull in industrial data use cases. And we've pulled in data that we train for the DoD in some circumstances. And all of that feeds a central engine, right? We don't train different products. We don't have three different systems. We have one software product, and it runs across all three of those verticals.
So I want to sort of put this into the hardware context for a sec, because you mentioned earlier, right, that you've been doing sort of a new truck every year. Obviously, you have constant iteration on the software side. That's the great thing about software. But with hardware, you have real trade-offs, right? And so you forgive me for saying this. I think Kodiak has probably never had the biggest fleet of trucks on the road of other players. But you've been able to iterate. I think being able to iterate every year. Talk to us a little bit about how that strategy has sort of played into your ability to survive and thrive.
Sure, the hardware is incredibly important to what we're doing. And on one hand, you ask the question, well, what are the OEMs going to provide? How are you going to scale this business? I think I've mentioned possibly on this show before that I don't like the word scale, because people don't seem to have a good have a sense for what that actually means. And I think you need to frame scale in terms of breaking even and getting to profitability, right? A path to profitability. That's where I tend to think about scale. And when you talk about our hardware generations, we recognized very early on that if you rely solely on the OEMs, you suddenly have handed the keys to your success to a third party, and you're sort of waiting for them to deliver a product. And it's a challenging thing to do, especially when you don't have a lot of experience in autonomy. And of course, we have great relationships with OEMs, and they're all working incredibly hard to deliver a safe and reliable platform that they can stand behind, that they've validated, and that they really believe in. But it's taking a long time. It's taking a long time, and we just don't know exactly when it's going to get here. So many years ago, we made the decision that we need to build a system independently, in-house, that we architect, that we can control, that we can build. And you talk, you know, what scale? Well, you know, we can build thousands of them. We couldn't build 100,000 of them, but do we need to build 100,000? I think a lot of people only see that kind of terminal state where, again, all the vehicles on the road are autonomous, and you think, well, how do we get there? Well, of course, we have to have the OEMs, and we have to have all this ecosystem and supply chain built up around it. But my focus right now, and where I think all AV companies should be focused on, is getting that first driverless truck, getting the first 10 driverless trucks, getting the first 100 driverless trucks, and then ultimately getting to a point where you're a profitable company. Once you're a profitable company, now you have the time to you know, basically play the slow game, make sure the ecosystem comes around, and then ultimately you're going to win. And so that's kind of our mindset for building this independent hardware solution, which now is going into production, and we're going to actually be providing to a customer for the first time, by the way. So this will be the first time that a driverless truck or possibly driverless vehicle is owned by the customer, right? All driverless deployments today, as far as I'm aware, are owned by the company that designed the technology, right? So this is a huge step, not only for Kodiak, but I think also for the industry. And it would not have been possible had we not been iterating on those generations of the hardware.
Under your business model, which you just laid out, how many trucks do you believe you need to reach that profitability milestone?
We need to be operating about, or rather, we need to have provided about 350 to 400 trucks in order to break even, which is an order of magnitude less than our competitors, or possibly even more. And so it's a much lower barrier because we've been able to keep our costs down. And this has been important for us since the very beginning of the company. And we talked about the ecosystem and not vertically integrating every component like network switches and other things, a year and a half ago when we talked last. That has allowed us to keep our burn super low. And that is exciting to investors. And that also means that it's a much easier bar to hit in terms of getting to profitability. And ultimately, again, I think the technology is fun and we can talk about that, but that era has passed. It's no longer about who has the best tech. Now it's about who can actually survive to profitability the quickest. And those are the companies that are ultimately going to go on to win.
So earlier, Don, you mentioned that so many people in the AV space had just talked about, you know, blue sky futures without talking about what the product and go-to-market would be in the interim. And there's 1,000 steps there. And maybe 1,000 businesses to be built on the way there. So I had a client of my consulting business last year who was an automated construction. And they were trying to automate construction on the site. And so when they diagrammed what that looked like, the friction points remained. Trucks arrive from a distribution point, Home Depot, some with construction supplies. They drive up a road. They arrive at the construction site. Now the stuff's got to come off the truck and get onto the site so automation can then do its thing. There are so many breaks in the food chain, and this is true of every vertical. When are we going to see these friction points be reduced in a meaningful way? Whether it's a truck with attachments, humanoid robots, some simpler robot. When are we going to see adjacent verticals connected with automation beyond just what you're doing with AV?
Well, it's the obvious next step. I think it's hard to say when these days. It's always a bad bet to bet on when it comes to autonomy. But if you look at closing the loop in terms of capabilities, now we can drive on highway environments. We can drive off highway onto surface street environments. We can drive into retail centers. We can go into off-road environments, unstructured environments, through the field, through the forest, and we can do it all on one AI system. And we can connect those in a single run, by the way. We can do everything I just said without ever turning the system off or changing anything. And so you can imagine we're not very far from extending that into job sites, construction sites, because those are just an extension of the industrial use case that we're already trying to tackle. Now, what I don't know is, are those vehicles the same kind of vehicle, right? Or do we need to tow a trailer? Or like, is there something else involved that's mechanical? Because anytime you have a mechanical linkage, that's typically where you need to introduce people into the equation. But I don't think we're very far off from being able to close the loop of truck gets loaded at a local Home Depot, drives to a construction site, is able to turn from the road straight into the site, right? And then deliver the materials specifically to where they need to go. Now, if there's specialized jobs that need to get done with autonomy, then I'm not exactly sure how we're going to close the loop on that. But you can imagine that this is all going to be streamlined in the future, right? Now that we have driverless deployments in these industrial applications, it's real, it's here today. It's not a far leap to imagine the next step of connecting over-the-road vehicles to off-road vehicles.
Sort of a similar question that I have, you know, you can do so much to develop, you know, amazing technology and stuff, but a lot of like, and especially with automation, you know, certainly in like the industrial context, like you think about like Toyota and stuff, like they have these whole continuous improvement processes that they eventually get to the point where they understand, okay, we need to take to automate something to take the next step in eliminating waste and improving efficiency and or throughput or whatever it is they're trying to do. So there's like definitely on the customer side this need to understand like we have a use case that this meets this technology, right? And I think over the time we've all been paying attention to this sector, and you've obviously been doing quite a long time, you know, there's been a lot of like wrong ideas about like what the right use cases are going to be or whatever. How much work still happens, you know, has to happen there in terms of like your potential customer base becoming more familiar with the technology, what its capabilities are, what it's not, so that they can really know with a high level of confidence, okay, now is the right time for us as a business to reach out to a company like Kodiak and say like, hey, let's start talking about actually like using this technology to solve real problems.
It turns out it's all over the spectrum. So there are some companies that have no clue, who are not sure, they don't understand the technology, they don't understand how it can help them. And then there are some companies that they really get it. I would say Atlas is definitely one of the companies that get it. It didn't take us going to them and describing how we can improve the efficiency of their business. They effectively came to us and said, hey, we've seen what you're doing in these off-road use cases. We think this would be a perfect application for autonomy in our business use case. And by the way, we're already innovating in ways that nobody thought was possible. If you don't know, you should look into it. They're building a 42-mile conveyor belt in the desert to move sand across roads to increase the efficiency of their business. And autonomy is just a next extension for that. So it was very easy to envision the future with a company like Atlas because they already got it. It didn't require any selling. Now, obviously, they wanted to see it work, and we had to show up and say, yeah, see here, it works. And like I said, we demonstrated that a while back now, and we're doing full end-to-end sand deliveries with no driver in the cab now, and we're deploying the first vehicles to them over the next couple of months and quarters. So it's that's kind of one end of the spectrum, and then there's everything in between. A lot of the long-haul trucking companies, they get it. They've been convinced autonomy is the future. They know it's the future of their business. Every company is a little bit different in how they operate. I mean, that's one of the things that makes companies special is that they have different efficiencies. They have different operations. And so we definitely still need to take a step to go in and work with them on their specific operating domain and tie in their APIs, connect up to their computer systems. Often very legacy systems, as you can imagine. We call them transportation management systems, TMSs. So there's some work to do there. But by and large, we don't get a lot of pushback these days. People see the future, they see the potential, they see the efficiency gains, they see the cost savings, and they want it. And their only question is, when is it going to be here, right? That's really the only remaining question.
Have you had any issues with hiring because of your work in defense?
We have not had any issues hiring. In fact, the hiring environment for companies that are thriving, like Kodiak, is stronger than it's ever been because so many other companies are either not hiring or going through layoffs. And so I would say, at least in the Valley, the availability of top talent is as high as it's ever been since we've been operating. And people see the path that Kodiak is on in terms of real driverless deployment. And that's super motivating. People want to work on a real product. I mean, I'm sure you've heard the old adage from anyone in the self-driving industry that they've never really shipped a product. There are a few exceptions of people who actually have a driverless product out there, which is amazing. But by and large, people want to work at a company where they can see a tangible path to deployment. And that's something that Kodiak offers. So yeah, we haven't really had any trouble hiring. And in fact, we have seen a lot of support for defense. There's always a handful of folks that they don't want to work on that. And so they're unhappy with that path. The real challenge comes in hiring US citizens or, US people, because that becomes a restriction if you're going to work in the classified defense space. And by the way, all the work that we're doing at Kodiak is so far unclassified. But, if you want to really go deep in defense, then ultimately that will limit the pool of applicants that you can consider, which of course makes hiring harder. But, we get tens of thousands of applicants more than we can even think about because we're such a small company. So hiring is not a challenge right now.
So I wanted to ask about something that I know we've talked about before when you've been here in the past, but I think it's fascinating is just, you know, this space, everyone in, who's a part of the space has been constantly learning this whole time, continues to constantly learn. I'm really curious if there's anything that you've been learning as you approach the goal of driverless operations. You know, how do you, has how you think about that step, right? And this has always been sort of the, there's so much that goes into it, but ultimately kind of boils down to that, take that leap to driverless. Has your thinking about taking that step changed at all recently? You know, obviously it's the goal, sort of where, how are you thinking about that these days?
I don't know if this is the where you were going with the question, but, you know, from my seat, what I've come to realize as a technologist, it's no longer about the technology. People don't care about the technology. What actually matters is customer service. At the end of the day, we have a customer. They have a real business. They want their business to be successful. They want their business to be efficient. You're trying to sell them a product that you are claiming is going to make their business more successful. And the relationship you build with the customers is everything. The product that you provide, the service levels that you provide, the reliability of the product, how well you respond when things go wrong. These are the things I start to think about, because ultimately driverless deployment is all about the end user. It's about the customer. And so you really have to build, I mean, we think of the AV industry as a very tech heavy industry, and it is naturally, of course, but now we're making the transition into more of a customer service based company. And we need to think about those things. And the relationships you build with those customers are as valuable as the technology that you're building. And so that's really, I would say, the thing I've realized, kind of just a direction that we've needed to go. It's all about, all right, what type of relationship are we building? What type of customer service are we providing? What type of support are we going to have in the field? And that's going to define our success. And that's ultimately going to be the differentiation by which customers see these products. Because nobody can look at the tech and decide who's better. I'll say our tech's better. They'll say their tech's better. And nobody can really see it from the outside. It all looks shiny. It all looks nice. We can produce awesome videos. But at the end of the day, it's the customer service and the reliability. So that's really where I focus my time. And that's where the team is really focusing their time these days.
And to some extent, I mean, you're sort of saying, right, it's about building a trusting relationship. And to some extent, it sounds a little bit, just sort of reading between the lines and comparing to what others, the situation that other players in the AV space are in, you know, you're not in a position where you have to necessarily build a trust-based relationship with an entire city, for example, or you know, the state government, right? And is this sort of one of the advantages of moving off-road? It's not just about technological sophistication. It's about you can just build a trust-based relationship with the necessary stakeholders in a more simple way than in downtown San Francisco?
You know, I haven't really thought about it like that, but now that you say it, absolutely, right? There's fewer stakeholders that you have to be accountable to when you have a large company as your customer. And obviously it's the employees of that company, it's the leadership of that company. But yes, absolutely. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I was excited about the commercial market in the very beginning, is because I think that the constituencies that are involved in the transaction will be fewer, and therefore it's in some ways it's easier to provide a high quality of service when you don't have as many customers that you have to serve.
Well, this has been fascinating as always, Alex. I'll shut up now and let you get all heard in edgewise to take us home.
I'm curious to know if for a long time when I was at Argo, the concern was that one of the other big four like robotaxi developers would have a catastrophic incident, which would cast a shadow on the other ones. And, you know, I don't recall really discussing whether an AV trucking incident would cast a shadow on robotaxi. But in general, the media considers all AV kind of a monolithic thing. Has there been any fallout for you, or regulatory conversations or otherwise? Any fallout because of, say, the Cruise incidents which occurred last year upon AV trucking or Kodiak directly?
We haven't really. And I think that's a testament to the relationships that we've built with the regulators at all levels, the municipal level, the state level, the federal level. And whether or not the media or the public kind of lops it all into one big bucket, I think we have been very successful in differentiating our business from the robotaxis, the cruise-like incidents. And I think it goes to show that it's really all about relationships. It's about the response. It's about being honest. It's about being open. And we're super proud that we've never had an on-road incident in our autonomous, as a result of the operation of our autonomous system. People have run into our trailer before a few times, but nothing related to the actual autonomy performance of our system. And that's something we take very seriously. And that's something that we obviously talk to the regulators about. And so I'm kind of beyond that fear. I don't actually think that one company's actions will derail the entire industry. There was certainly a period in time where we all felt that that would be the case, but there have been so many incidents now over the last 15 plus years that time and time again, the industry as a whole has shown its ability to bounce back, its resiliency in the eyes of adversity or things that occur on the road, like the cruise incident. So it's not something I worry about so much anymore. I think we're past that, and I think our safety record speaks for itself.
Well, thanks so much. And that wraps up another episode of the Autonicast.
Thanks, Don.
All right. Always a pleasure.